There we go. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director. Got a wonderful show for you tonight. This is one of our rare art shows with artists from several different arenas. First, of course, the news. We cannot tolerate expanded industrial drilling activities that pose a threat to the drinking water and surface water so close to the Florida Everglades, Senator Nelson wrote Thursday in a letter to EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy. Recent discoverings of a fracking-like incident there raise serious concerns about whether outside wildcatters would soil one of the world's greatest environmental treasures. Oh my God! Somebody woke up Bill Nelson! He's actually getting involved in something that will actually help Floridians! I can't believe it. For the first time ever, Collier County is challenging the DEP on oil drilling. Collier County commissioners voted unanimously to challenge the DEP's consent order on the Collier Hogan well that was illegally fracked near Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. They're calling for a revocation of the Dan A. Hughes permit because no amount of regulation will make it safe if the company won't obey the regulations. They accuse Hughes of misrepresentation and lying and registered alarm and anger that the DEP failed to disclose the criminal wrongdoing at the recent public hearings. Failing revocation, they're calling for permit conditions that include strong oversight, monitoring, and direct communications with DEP, as well as a list of 10 staff recommendations submitted by Dan Summers, Director of Emergency Management, earlier in the year. They intend to seek legislative delegation help. It's time to thank the commissioners for decisive action. As ML King says, the time is always right to do right. We are also asking them to expand their petition, as Donna Fiala called it, to include excellent permit conditions recommended by the Conservancy at the meeting. The DEP's Big Cypress Advisory Committee, reconvened for the first time in decades, had recommended that the judge and DEP deny the Golden Gate permit. For years, the government has upheld the principle of net neutrality, the belief that everyone should have equal access to the web without preferential treatment. But now, Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC and former cable and telecommunications top gun, is circulating potential new rules that would reportedly put a price tag on climbing aboard the internet. The largest and richest providers, giant corporations such as Verizon and Comcast, in mid-takeover of Time Warner, they like that idea. They can afford to buy their way to the front of the line. Everyone else, not-for-profit groups, startups, everyday users, small mom-and-pop websites, would be moving to the rear of the bus, and the net would be neutral no more. Most Americans have no choice for all the information, data, and entertainment coming through their house other than their local cable monopoly. And here we have a situation where monopoly potentially can pick and choose winners and losers, decide what you see, basically, Crawford tells Moyers. Carr added, people have a close and intimate relationship with the web in a way they don't have any other technology. They have the precious proprietary feelings about it, and I'm not sure the FCC really knows what they're getting into. Yes, the internet, your internet, our internet, the electronic public square that ostensibly allows everyone an equal chance to be heard. This democratic highway to cyberspace has thrived on the idea of net neutrality. We were promised it by candidate Obama. Of course, that was before we appointed the current FCC chair. That the internet would be available to all without preferential treatment, but net neutrality is now at risk. And from its supposed guardian, the FCC. The FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, is circulating potential new rules that reportedly would allow the internet service providers to charge higher fees for faster access, so that big companies like Verizon and Comcast could hustle more money for those who can afford to buy a place in the fast lane. Everyone else, not-for-profit groups, startups, and the others, forget about it. A final decision on the new rules isn't expected until later this year, so you have a chance to be heard during an official comment period. And we'll tell you more about that, but let's listen to two people. And there was recently a Moyers interview that you should definitely check out. This news from Ed Snowden. We're all being spied on now. The people's privacy is violated without any suspicion of wrongdoing, said former National Security Agency contractor. The U.S. intelligence whistleblower Ed Snowden has warned that entire populations, rather than just individuals, now live under constant surveillance. It's no longer based on the traditional practice of targeting taps based on some individual's suspicion. He said it covers phone calls, emails, texts, search history, what you buy, who your friends are, where you go, and who you love. Snowden made his comments in a short video that was played before a debate on the proposition that surveillance today is a euphemism for mass surveillance in Toronto, Canada. Former U.S. National Security Agency contractors living in Russia, having been granted temporary asylum once his passport was confiscated and denied by the U.S. Video was shown as two of the debates, the former U.S. National Security Director, General Michael Hayden, and the well-known civil liberties lawyer and Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz. They argued in favor of the debate statement, "Be it resolved that state surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedom." Opposing the motion was Glenn Greenwald, a journalist whose work is based on Snowden's leaks and won a Pulitzer Prize for The Guardian last month, argued in favor. "Be it resolved." Okay. And also Alex Ohanian, co-founder of the social media website Reddit, opposed. The Snowden document, first leaked to The Guardian last June, revealed the U.S. government has programs in place to spy on hundreds of millions of people's email, social networking posts, online chat histories, browsing histories, telephone records, telephone calls, and text. Nearly everything a typical user does on the Internet, in the words of one leaked document. Greenwald opened the debate by condemning the NSA's own slogan, which he said appears repeatedly throughout its own documents. And that slogan is, collect it all. What is state surveillance, Greenwald asked. If it were about targeting in a discriminated way against those causing harm, there'd be no debate. The actual system of state surveillance has almost nothing to do with that. What state surveillance actually is defended by NSA's own actual words and the phrase that they use over and over and over again, collect it all. Dershowitz and Hayden spent the rest of 90 minutes of the debate denying that a pervasive surveillance system described by Snowden and Greenwald even exists, and that surveillance programs are necessary to prevent terrorism. Collect it all doesn't mean collect it all, said Hayden, drawing some humorous snickers. Greenwald sparred with Dershowitz and Hayden about whether or not the present collection of microdata one of the reasons USA authorities failed to prevent the attack was they're taking in too much information to accurately sort through it all. On the Fukushima front, continued engineering bad news. Experts question the ice wall planned for the Japanese nuclear plant. Experts on Friday expressed skepticism about a plan to build a costly underground frozen wall at Japan's crippled nuclear plant, a development that could delay the start of construction on the project. Experts on Friday expressed skepticism about a plan to build it. Experts and Japanese nuclear regulatory officials said in a meeting in Tokyo that they weren't convinced that the project can resolve a serious containment water problem at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, which has suffered multiple meltdowns following the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. I do want to take a minute to mention two other items before we go on with the Fukushima news. There's two stories that you should be aware of, two events coming up. Right now, PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, their former leader, Tim Carpenter, has recently passed away, and they're doing a fundraiser to celebrate the anniversary of PDA. So if you have enjoyed PDA's good works over the years, please find your way to the PDA site and see if you can contribute a little something to the PDA and the Tim Carpenter cause. Also, I want to mention that coming up an event from the Progressive Caucus of Florida's Democratic Party, and that's coming up the week of the 16th, weekend of the 16th and 17th. If you can, make your plans to join us on out in Tampa. That's the 16th and 17th of May. If you go to the Progressive Democratic Party of Florida's caucus website or Facebook site, you can get more information about that. And now back to the news. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a contribution from our good friends at SEIU who are going to be giving us their final report of the legislative session. So here we go, Rebecca Wakefield and the SEIU Tallahassee Report. Here we go. And without any further ado, let me bring you our good friends, our brothers and sisters from SEIU and One Miami. Here we go. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Is this the charming and talented
here.
Rebecca?
Well, it's Rebecca, at least. So, we finally made it. It's the last day of the session. We're recording this on a Friday, so technically they still have a few more hours to screw things up in Tallahassee, but most of the work is done as of this moment. And so here we are. We made it through the session. Some people are calling this the best legislature money can buy. I think you can see that based on, you know, the sorts of priorities that the leadership had, whether it's Governor Scott or the Senate President or the Speaker of the House. Unfortunately, the stuff that they really concentrated on were tax breaks and
failing pensions
systems, like and just fixing things that aren't broken. So unfortunately, those were their priorities. Meanwhile, they really didn't focus on the basic needs of working Floridians and the middle class. They refused once again to expand health care to about 1 million uninsured Floridians, and that's despite the fact that even with all of that, about 1 million Floridians signed up for Obamacare this year. So, I mean, we're one of the biggest states in the country that where its citizens really signed up for health care. So that's a glaring legacy that they have created for this session. They also really worked to make charter schools less accountable. They put themselves in private health decisions between a woman and her doctor on abortion issues. They refused to talk about raising the minimum wage, equal pay for women. You know, I mean, you name it. They really did not do well overall. And they, you know, as of today, they will presumably pass a $77 billion budget towards the end of the day. That said, there not all of it was bad news. I mean, there were some good things that happened for the people of Florida. I think one of the most interesting things to watch this session was definitely the debate over whether to allow undocumented students brought to Florida as children to pay in-state tuition, just like their peers that they went to elementary and high school with have that. And, you know, we were behind on that. There were several other states who had passed that before: California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Minnesota, Nebraska, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Oklahoma, Oregon, Texas, Utah, Virginia, and Washington. And there's some pretty conservative states in that mix, and they had all passed in-state tuition bills that would help undocumented students. Well, we finally got there. So after much, much debate, after thousands of people wrote letters, signed petitions, went up to the state capitol this session, they finally passed it. And that's, I think, pretty historic, and it kind of gives you a preview of where this state might be heading. I mean, I can't imagine this getting passed last year, the year before, but we got there, and so now it's going to go to Governor Scott's desk, and I'd be very surprised if he doesn't sign it. So that's a huge, huge thing, I think, for Florida, because it really kind of puts us on the map and says we value our young people, we value our students, and we welcome them. And I think kind of it was interesting to watch not only the debate over this, but some of the other immigration-related legislation that came up pertaining to driver's licenses, and there's a law student who is not a citizen who wanted to be admitted to the Florida bar, and, you know, so there's a lot of interesting things going on, and it was really fascinating to watch some of the members of the Republican Party kind of twist themselves into knots on how to deal with this in their various regions of the state. But I think it really shows that the Republicans understand that the clock is ticking on their hegemony in Florida, particularly nationally as well. But in Florida, you know, the numbers just speak to where we're heading. And 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're not going to be having the same conversations we have now. You know, they'll be the ones, you know, having these radio shows and talking about how they can't get anything through Tallahassee. So it's really good.
Save the poor dumb rednecks, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and I think we're going to end up with a much more rich society that's good for everyone. I mean, I think when you raise the floor, it raises it for everybody. So that's just really excellent. Some of the other good things that happened were basically bad bills were stopped. We spoke about pensions. That was a huge priority for the House Speaker, Will Weatherford. He put a lot of his political capital on the line for that and passed it in the House. And basically, it was new employees that entered the state pension system would be, in one way or another, kind of forced into a 401k style investment plan rather than pension. And the reason to do that is basically just to destabilize the pension, you know, by shrinking the pool of people that are in it. Fortunately, it died in the Senate, and that was all to the good. So that, you know, a lot of opposition from different labor groups and other organizations helped kill that. Another good thing that happened is that a Republican attempt to destroy the wage theft ordinances that we have in Miami-Dade and Broward, they wanted to take those away, but that also failed. So that's another win for the little guy. Close to home for us in Miami, we were fighting a couple of things related to hospitals. One was just how Medicaid payments get distributed to different hospitals, and they were going to redistribute the wealth, so to speak, away from kind of the public nonprofit hospitals and start giving it more to some of the private institutions in other parts of the state. And that was going to have a devastating effect on a lot of different hospitals, including Jackson and Miami. But they've gone ahead and said, okay, we're not going to implement that this year. We're going to do it next year. So that gives us a year to try to get something that's a lot more fair, that's not going to impact safety net hospitals. Another thing that we were fighting personally from Local 1991 in Miami, we had some Republicans try to take away, try to hurt labor contracts at the public hospital by taking away the power from the county commission and giving it to an unelected public health trust board. So they got that through the House, and we managed to get it killed in the Senate. So several good things did happen amongst all the negative things that happened in this legislature. So overall, I would say not a terrible session, not great. They definitely fell down on a number of things, particularly health care. But
I understand,
know,
some money was put aside to help fund medical tourism. So the legislature is happy to have foreigners and people travel here to get medical care. They just didn't really want medical care for Floridians.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic. It's just really amazing how the Republican mentality, not all Republicans, but certainly the leadership, is really aimed at diverting resources to a small group of business interests and not towards the people who are paying the taxes and making the state what it is. You know,
you mean their employers?
Yeah. I mean, it's really incredible to think about that.
You know, I was wondering, so, there was... There was one other issue we spoke about briefly, but I wasn't sure how it was resolved. Do you know, are we safe from Pop-Tarts chewed into the shape of a gun?
You know what? I don't know as of this moment where that landed. Like I said, we're recording this, you know, before the session is completely over. And we've got a few more hours to go, so
it may be rolled into the budget bill. You never know.
I'm not exactly sure, and I apologize that I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not going to lose any sleep either way over that one.
We shouldn't just be scared about that.
I mean, I think we should be concerned about Pop-Tarts in general. Those probably should be banned. They probably kill more people than...
Well, I want to thank you for the wonderful work you've done and the tremendous spirit that you've brought to this. I'll have to call myself colored amazed that you found so many good things to talk about end of the session.
Right. I mean, I guess those are some of the things that we were following very closely. And, you know, sometimes it helps to have a positive outlook, you know, and realize that considering that this is a Republican-controlled legislature, that the Democrats are a minority and they have a hell of a time of getting anything through. It shows that we are building power slowly and that we are moving forward towards making Florida more progressive. It feels like an excruciating pace at times. There are many maddening things that happen along the way, but overall, you know, I think we're going in the right direction, little by little.
Well, you know, I especially want to thank you and SEIU for this in particular reason. I was just reading a political writer out of the West Coast this morning, and he mentioned that as a political writer whose job is the Tallahassee beat, how difficult it is for him, whose profession it is, to track the progress of legislation. He said, you know, it's easy to get the numbers, the money, relatively speaking, to get that kind of information, but to actually follow the legislation, he said it's nearly impossible for him, whose job it is full-time to do that. And he lamented how disconnected the citizenry of Florida is from these... I'm just going to call them scoundrels up there who run that legislature, and how little they have any attention given to the needs and the interests of the Floridians who they are ostensibly representing. So I thank you for the great work you've done to bring information to Floridians and especially progressive activists.
Well, thank you, and it's not easy, and it is unfortunate that there is such a disconnect. I mean, if you've ever been to Tallahassee, it's its own little island. You know, it's basically this cute little southern town that, you know, is also one big frat house. You know, whether it's, you know, they've got a couple of colleges up there, and the legislature, you know, those guys act like a fraternity as well. And lots of shenanigans, lots of hazing, and unfortunately, so many things that they do up there make a huge difference to people in their neighborhoods, and we don't know what happened until well after it happens. You know, I read that same article, you know, where he talked about, you know, in just a 30 seconds, they spent $4.5 million on something, and nobody knew anything about it. And that's how it works. And they count on us not paying attention. They count on us not knowing what's going on. And they're so far away from the center of gravity of the state, which is central and south, really. And you know, most people don't have the time or resources to figure out what they're up to.
Yeah, I just thought it was remarkable, you know. Many of us in media, especially many of us progressive activists, you know, we lament that there's so few people involved. But, you know, when you think about it, the system is designed to preempt and to prevent people from being involved, even should they be interested. And I think that speaks,
yes.
It really speaks reams.
It sure does. But we're, you know, we're trying to shine a little light. It may just be a pen light at this point, but we're, you know, we're trying to get people aware, and because I think once people know what's going on, they understand how it affects them directly, they start to take action, you know, and that's what we all have to count on.
Well, I want to thank you, and please send our thanks to everyone at SEIU 1991 who was involved in this project. And I think you're doing a wonderful service, and I just hope it expands.
Okay, and anytime I need an ego boost, I'm just going to call you and have you talk to me again.
Well, in union there is solidarity, my sister. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was Rebecca Wakefield of SEIU 1991, who have, in their generosity, been joining us each week during the legislative session to give us their Tallahassee report. And we value that tremendously and hope to continue and expand our working with them. We've got a few more stories before we get our next news guest. We've got guests coming up, Flash, who's a wonderful producer and performer, and he's been instrumental in the medical marijuana benefits and the Everglades supporting benefits. And he should be joining us soon. And then we've got Miss Stephanie McMillan, a cartoonist and political activist, a superb artist in her own right. And then we've got jazz saxophonist extraordinaire, Mr. Randy Emmerich, will be joining us as our final guest of the evening. So I'm glad you joined us. And here's a little something I think you'll like. With the String Cheese Incident from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Fair ongoing right now in the wonderful city of New Orleans. Right now, a little bit more news. The Senate agrees the U.S. people cannot know overseas drone death toll. The newest thing in secret warfare? You don't need to know, said the U.S. government. At the behest of intelligence chief, the Senate removes modest provision that would have revealed the number of people killed by U.S. drone attacks overseas. The Senate Intelligence Committee and the Obama administration agree on this. The American people should not know the number of people killed by U.S. drone attacks overseas, nor should they hope to understand the circumstances under which such lethal killings are authorized or executed. And, of course, as the Attorney General once explained, due process means we do a process. Hey, you know, may not be anything judicial, but, hey, there is a process. So we do a process, so therefore the due process requirements of the Constitution are observed. This high-level agreement was confirmed on Monday after a modest provision designed to add transparency to the U.S. drone assassination program was killed in the Senate committee following objections by the Obama administration intelligence chief. At the behest of the Director of National Intelligence, U.S. senators have removed a provision that would require the president to publicly disclose information about the drone strikes and their victims. This story from our good friend and frequent guest, Mr. Steve Horn, about the pipelines crisscrossing this great nation of ours. If nothing else, it's a good way to keep those railroad spills to a minimum. Gulfstream, Williams suspends bluegrass gas export pipeline, announcing a new export line. This from Desmog Blog, again by Steve Horn. Right before the champagne bottles began popping for activists engaged in a grassroots struggle to halt the construction of the Williams Company's prospective bluegrass pipeline, which the company suspended indefinitely in an April 28th press release, Williams had already begun raining on the parade. The pipeline industry giant took out the trash on Friday, April 25th, announcing its intentions to open a new Louisiana pipeline named the Gulf Trace. Akin to the TransCanada ANR pipeline recently reported on by Smog Blog, Gulf Trace is not entirely new per se. Rather, it's a retooling of a pipeline system already in place, in this case, the Williams Transco pipeline system. This retooling has taken place in the aftermath of Cheniere's Sabine Pass LNG export facility receiving the first ever final gas export permit from the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, during the fracking era. Both ANR and Gulf Trace will feed into Sabine Pass, and the Louisiana-based LNG export terminal is set to open for business in late 2015. Also, like ANR, Transco will transform into a gas pipeline flowing in both directions, bi-directional in industry lingo. Bluegrass, if ever built, would also transport fracked gas to the Gulf Coast export markets, but instead of LNG, bluegrass is a natural gas liquids pipeline. That's the NGL of song and story. The project is designed to connect NGLs produced in the Marcellus Utica area in the U.S. Northeast with domestic and export markets in the U.S. Gulf Coast, as explained in an April 28th press release. Still torturing after all these years, a group of psychologists who've been outspoken in opposing the use of U.S. medical professionals in interrogation have released a letter to President Barack Obama and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel condemning the ongoing use of interrogation techniques amounting to cruel and unusual punishment, torture, and the degrading treatment of prisoners. The use of such techniques are found in the current Army Field Manual. It will be available, as will all these news stories, in the Avery Voice site. And in particular, its special Appendix M, which summarizes a set of techniques under the label separation that are only meant to be used on prisoners who the U.S. government claims don't meet the additional prisoner of war protections of the Geneva Conventions, prisoners like those held in indefinite detention at Guantanamo. I ask you, when you hear the words indefinite detention, I want you to immediately remember the guarantees of the Magna Carta and the writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus, indefinite detention. I want you to just keep those two thoughts simultaneously in your mind. Even so, most human rights and legal groups have found the techniques under question: solitary confinement, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation, the manipulation of diet and environment, the use of fear and emotional abuse of prisoners to be against Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, the UN Convention Against Torture, and other international as well as domestic laws. See, contrary to Obama's promises, the U.S. military still permits torture, and that's from the British Guardian of January 25th, 2014, way back in January of this year. Not mentioned in the letter signed by Stephen Reisner, president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, on behalf of his organization, is the recent discovery that the use of torture techniques derived from the government program to help military personnel resist torture, that's the famous SEER program, was never really removed from the military's Army Field Manual. Instead, the Pentagon used obfuscation language and obscure references to hide the fact from the casual onlooker. Indeed, the current Army Field Manual on interrogations, including its Appendix M, was the subject of a Pentagon, the subject of an Office of Legal Counsel 2006 memorandum by torture memo author Stephen Bradbury. While President Obama rescinded most of the Bush-era torture memos when he first came into office, he never rescinded the Bradbury memo of Appendix M. That's a dial M for appendix. To this day, the use of methods amounting to torture in the U.S. Army Field Manual continue, and while this is opposed by nearly every human rights group that has looked at the torture question, from Amnesty International to Physicians for Human Rights, from the Center for Constitutional Rights to the Constitution Project, congressional oversight personnel at Senator Carl Levin's Armed Services Committee state that the procedures in the Army Field Manual and its Appendix M are not abusive. Hey, what do all those human rights people know? The procedures in the Army Field Manual currently are backed by presidential executive order, and the methods are used by both the Department of Defense and the CIA. No longer permits. Does SASC admit Appendix M once did prevent torture? If no longer permits such use of cruel and inhuman techniques, nor violate international obligations, can someone at SASC inform us of when that change took place and what did the change consist of? I don't think we'll ever get an answer to those questions. And as long as the mainstream media, including the so-called alternative outlets, continue to ignore the current use of torture by the U.S. government, apologists and those who cover for the use of torture have nothing to lose by keeping mum. History will not treat such cowardice and dishonesty kindly. And we're going to go ahead and play that in just a minute. There is a full text of the letter included in this news story. But I want to play a little something for you. This was Senator Warren recently on Rachel Maddow talking about her new book. And that book is called A Fighting Chance. I think you should hear this.
The interview is Elizabeth Warren, Democratic Senator from Massachusetts. Senator Warren, I was trying to embarrass you.
You did.
Oh, good.
You did.
It's hard to look at old tape of oneself, but you have been making really consistent arguments for a really long time on the same subjects.
Well, because this is what I see. This is what I really believe in. You know, for me, I was thinking about this as you were doing. I grew up in a family that was really kind of out there on the ragged edges of the middle class. My dad ended up as a maintenance man. My mom worked minimum wage job at Sears. And I ended up in the United States Senate. How does something like that happen? Well, partly it happens because I went to public school, public university, a commuter college that cost $50 a semester. I grew up in an America that was investing in its kids, an America that said, you know, if you work hard, if you get out there, you play by the rules, we're going to make a public school alternative that is affordable and will give you a great education. And that opened a million doors for me. And the reason I keep fighting now is we used those opportunities back then to build a strong and robust middle class, really basically, from the Great Depression until about the 1980s. We built that middle class. We built our hopes and our dreams in it. And then you hit the 1980s, and instead it starts to shift. The Republicans say, you know, what we really have to do is we've got to open up a bunch of tax loopholes, and the way we're going to pay for that is we're going to cut back on what we spend on educating our kids. We're going to cut back on the basic infrastructure, those roads and bridges and power grids that let businesses get started and move forward. We're going to cut back on funding basic research in this country, that great pipeline of ideas that had built so much innovation and creation. And so we end up in an America today where most kids can't pay for college. Mom and dad cannot afford to write a check that's going to get them through college. So what happens? The American government says, we're going to lend you the money to go to college, but they don't actually spell out what's going to happen next. You're going to pay back the cost of the funds, you're going to pay back the bad debts, covering that, the administrative costs. And then if you're an undergrad, we're going to charge you nearly double the amount you would have to cover all those costs, so that the United States government can make tens of billions of dollars in profits off the backs of our kids. That is obscene. And what it does is it further makes it tough for any kid to get a fighting chance. So that's the heart of what this book is about for me. It's the work I've been doing all along, and it's the work I'm going to keep on.
Jeff, the first piece of legislation that you filed when you got to Washington was on that student loan issue. And we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about whether or not the time that you have spent in Washington makes you realize what you'll have to do to win on that fight that you did not win when you first brought it up. Can you hold on?
Yep.
And that's an excerpt of Senator Elizabeth Warren talking with Rachel Maddow about her new book, A Fighting Chance. And if you've ever attended college, if you have children who will attend college, this is a book you want to read, and this is a fight you want to be part of. Now, let me continue with that letter on the issue of torture. This was written to the president from Psychologists for Social Responsibility. President Barack Obama, Mr. President, an organization of health professionals dedicated to human rights advocacy, Psychologists for Social Responsibility strongly objects to practices that violate the ethics of health professionals and lie outside the norms of international law and practice. The recent report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence confirms that beginning during the Bush administration, interrogation and detention practices were put in place by the CIA that constitute torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Practices once condemned under law and international treaty were soon redefined by the Justice Department to permit a culture of torture to proliferate under U.S. policy. These practices quickly spread to the detention centers, the U.S. Department of Defense, and throughout the theaters of war. While legal processes have been made to limit these policies and practices, significant remnants remain under your authority. We write to you today to urge you to eliminate all existing procedures allowing for torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of detainees. In 2009, via Executive Order 13491, your administration officially announced its intention to end the torture practices developed and instituted under the Bush administration. Interrogation practices that did not conform to the Army Field Manual were abolished. However, as documented by numerous legal and human rights groups, as well as by former interrogators, the Army Field Manual still includes abusive techniques in violation of these standards. We concur with the recent recommendation of the Institute on Medicine as a Profession, Open Society Foundation report, calling for you to issue a new executive order banning interrogation techniques using isolation, sleep deprivation, exploitation of fear, and other methods that violate international humane standards regarding torture and other forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. We, too, urge you to remediate the ethical standards of the Army Field Manual via the executive order. And you can read that and more if you go check out our site at avaryvoice.com. But now I'd like to welcome our next guest, Ms. Stephanie McMillan, cartoonist and political activist extraordinary. Stephanie, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, very good. I had the good fortune to meet you many years ago when we were first all greeted by the insult to the Gulf known as the BP Macondo well disaster. How have you been?
Mm-hmm. I've been fine, thank you. And I hope you've been fine too, and I'm glad to see that you're still working on changing the system.
Yep, you know, there's too many stories that just aren't being told, and I find it very stimulating to talk to activists each week who are doing the good work to make this help this earth survive. Each week we talk to people, whether they're involved in their environmental issues or human rights issues, and once every couple months we take a break and interview people that are using their arts and their creative talents to make this a better world. And Stephanie, that's why you're here.
Thank you. I'm also very active in organizing as well. So it's not just art for me. Art is for a purpose of building organizations that can actually take on and challenge the system and what it's doing to the planet.
Well, Stephanie, I was wondering, you know, it's always intriguing to me to find out how a person kind of finds themselves and makes that step in their life to become an activist. Let's first talk about your artwork. When did you find your pen and pencil and ink start to go in a political direction?
Well, I've always really liked drawing. And the first political cartoon I ever drew was in high school. It was an illustration for an article I wrote for the school paper against nuclear war. And that was during the Reagan era, so it seemed like a very real danger at the time. And that was when I also started learning about the nature of the system and how it's irredeemable and unreformable. And so that's, I've been active ever since. And also part of that time I wasn't working on any artwork. I was only an organizer. And it was only, about the early 90s that I started drawing cartoons again and seeing that as a way that I could possibly reach more people with a strong message, that if I made cute characters that people wanted to look at, that maybe they would be more open to reading the messages behind the artwork.
I agree with you completely. And I think that cartooning especially – I've always enjoyed history, and I was fortunate enough when I was young to be given some history books that showed those wonderful political and muckraking cartoons of the early 20th century, and the Condé Nast, the muckrakers of that wonderful era. Really, these guys and girls were men and women were just political activists. Who, and by and large, progressive activists who tried to point out to a largely illiterate audience, to an audience that didn't have the time or the patience to read a long tract, but they could look at a cartoon and often get all the ideas. You know, you look at a cartoon of an octopus, whether it's the Koch brothers or Condé Nast's Tammany Hall, and the idea comes across immediately.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's a visual way of expressing an idea, and if you add a few words to it, I think it's even more powerful because it reaches you in both those ways, the visual way and the, the through language. And so that combination, I think, it's a powerful form of communication, and I think memes on the internet are kind of like our modern-day version of some of those kind of cartoons.
Absolutely. I had a very... prolific period during the Bush years, because there was, I mean, you didn't have to wait another 2 days and there was another outrage.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
I published a website for an activist group down in Miami called Miami for Peace, and I had over 150 political cartoons up on that site at one time. So it was very stimulating, and it got a lot of good feedback. I was given a challenge one day that I thought was really interesting, and I'm going to kind of throw this to you too, to see what kind of thoughts it generates for you. I was at a rally and joined up with some people who were talking about the Bill of Rights and the insults to the Bill of Rights that came from the USA Patriot Act. And a couple of the people there said, "Rick, you know, you do such good anti-war cartoons. It's a shame that there's no way to draw any cartoons about the loss of Bill of Rights with the USA Patriot Act." And I said, "Well, thank you." And they said, "What?" I said, "Well, thank you. You just told me it couldn't be done." And there's there's no challenge like told it can't be, that it can't be done, to stimulate the artist to solve that problem. So I did a booklet on probably 12 different issues of the USA Patriot Act, and I drew little cartoons for them. I'll have to share that with you sometime. But, you know, if you think about it, whether it be fracking or the continued lust for war among some of these people, or the 1%, 99% paradigm there are so many issues that need a good cartoon.
It's true, and I think we need to also draw together all those issues and point to what's causing them all, which is the capitalist system. And it's a challenge to put those kind of difficult issues into a cartoon and make them both funny and meaningful and pointed and sharp. But I think a cartoon is actually an art form that can do it better than many others.
Let me ask you this. Is there a website online where you have some of your work posted? We could direct the audience to take a look at that?
Yeah. It's stephaniemcmillan.org. And you can see many years of archives of different work there. Currently I'm working on daily affirmations for the revolutionary proletarian militant.
Wow, cool.
It's a section of people who needs encouragement and never really gets it. And the previous series was about the global garment industry. It was more a comics journalism style. And then there are other sections of cartoons there that are more like long-form narrative, and they're gag cartoons. I've been through a lot of different styles and topics. So, but they're all political and very much against the system and its crime.
So StephanieMcMillan.org, and that's where they can find these. Great. Let me ask you this. Do you find yourself, I know myself, I went through phases where I would do, you know, one particular style or pick up a couple cartoon characters and work with them for a while. Are there any cartoon characters that you've kept around over a long period of time?
Yeah, there's a rabbit named Vanista and a guinea pig named Victoria. And these two seem to keep coming back even after I intend to not really use them as much. They come back anyway because they have such strong personalities and they often feel the same way as I do. So they are the mouthpieces for what I'm trying to say. And they just seem to work. So they keep coming back even through different phases of my cartoons.
Well, that sounds interesting. We'll have to look for that one. I want to tell you a funny story, and I want to ask you if you had a parallel. I was at a progressive conference, and there was a group of us talking about different ideas and how to reach out and how to engage more people. And a young woman walked up to our table and said, "I'm looking for some cartoonists. I need to get some environmental ideas across." Well, two of us spoke up. "Yeah, we're cartoonists. We'd be glad to help." So she said, "Well, look, here's what I'd like you to do. Do a cartoon about the environment and then send it to me." So I drew a cartoon of two dolphins swimming in the Gulf, and clearly from the Corexit, their fins had frayed. They were bleeding from the mouth and from the dorsal hole, and one turned to the other and said, "Well, it's a good thing all that Corexit disappeared." And so I sent it off to the young woman, and she didn't respond. And I thought, well, that's odd. You know, I thought it was a fairly effective cartoon. It was mildly funny and also and poignant, I think, as well. You know, very little was left to the imagination. You got the idea. And it was paired with another cartoon where I had a pelican drenched in oil, literally dripping with oil, who was looking back over his shoulder at some windmills on the coast saying, "They're such an eyesore."
Oh. Wow.
So I finally got in touch with her. I said, "So what'd you think? I mean, you know, did you like the cartoons? Were they effective? Do you think they spoke, you know?" She said, "Oh, my God, they were so strong. I mean, God, that would just scare people." And
what?
I said, "You know, cartoons are meant to be, you know, polemic. These are cartoons that are meant to make an argument." And I thought they spoke pretty good. Have you ever had that reaction, someone saying that, "Well, yeah, it's really effective, but damn, it's too effective"?
Yeah, well, I find that a lot of people don't really like a strong message, and that's not really what they're after. And I'm sorry that happened to you, because it sounds like they were very effective in saying what you wanted them to say, and that she seems kind of cowardly and not wanting to have that message out there. I mean, what was she trying to say about the Gulf then? If not, then it's a really horrible thing. I think it needs a strong message. But yes, that did happen. Recently, the cartoons about garment workers, somebody called and said they really liked them, wanted to use them for something, but would like to have them be more positive, and I shouldn't talk about garment workers being killed for organizing. So, well, okay, I'm not going to tame a message down when this is actually what's happening, and the purpose of my work is to expose these kind of crimes, and, you know, I'm being asked to tone it down. I think it's appalling when somebody asks an artist to do that, especially when they're revealing some kind of truth, like what you were doing with the pelicans.
Right, right. So what are you up to these days? That affirmation sounds wonderful. I'm looking forward to see those. What else are you working on right now?
Well, I just came out with a new book, and it's called Capitalism Must Die. And it's the basic to capitalism, what it is, how it works, why it's unreformable, and how people can organize to destroy it. And it's a mixture of cartoons and text. So it has the theoretical part and the practical part and then the amusing part all mixed together.
Oh, that sounds interesting. I know I saw some email about an event you had recently. I really lamented not being able to attend. It sounds like a great book. Is there a separate website for that, or is that part of your the StephanieMcMillan.org site?
That's a part of that site. It's available there both in print form and as a PDF. And the event that you're talking about was put on by One Struggle, which is an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist organization that I work with in South Florida. And if anyone's interested in that, the website for that is onestruggle.net.
onestruggle.net. Excellent.
Yeah, we just had a nice May Day rally and event, on 3 days ago.
Where was
it? The rally was in front of the Torch of Friendship, and then there was like a music and speaking event at VAO in Little Haiti in Miami.
Excellent. Yeah, you know, it's troubling when you see that what used to pass for a group of people who, while they differed with a more liberal perspective, were prepared to engage in a dialogue. I remember the famous debates between William F. Buckley and Mr. Gore, and it seems that the conservatives have given up the idea of an exchange of ideas. They want to win by subterfuge, or they want to win by essentially rigging the game. And I lament those days of having a good debate. And I think that the marketplace of ideas is where we can all prosper by sharing the benefit of wisdom and convincing people. But I don't know whether it's a lack of attention span or they just prefer to do it under the table. Have you drawn any conclusions on that point?
Well, I think the two, wings of the what I would call the dominant class, the capitalist class, the liberals and conservative, are two sides of the same coin, basically. And I don't think they really care anymore what we think. And so they don't have to convince us. They are just, they've kind of thrown us away as expendable. They don't require us to work in their factories anymore. So I think they just want us to be quiet. And they're using more repression instead of persuasion. As the economic and environmental crises get worse, I think that maybe they don't see debate as even very useful anymore. They just figure we'll either go along with things or they'll make us go along with things. So I guess that's probably how I see their lack of desire to convince us of anything.
I saw a discussion at Florida International University a year or two ago, and one of the voices of the Conservative Party, head of the Young Conservatives, came to the college to try to convince college students to go Republican. And he made the most ludicrous argument, and I don't know whether it was because of lack of historic awareness or whether it was just they were poorly educated, but this fellow tried to make a case that it was conservatives that are protecting free speech, and conservatives have been the ones protecting the rights of women and minorities.
Well, I don't know how anybody could say that.
Well, he basically just said it. He didn't make any, you know, didn't show any proof because obviously there was none available. But I pointed out when he asked if there was any questions that the conservatives have been on the wrong side of history as long as there's been conservatives. And he said,
yeah.
Well, you should just get your own radio show or something. And I said, you know, that's a good idea.
You should get your own what? I'm sorry.
Radio show.
Oh, well, yeah. And
so I took the only good advice he offered.
Uh-huh. And, yeah, that's that was a good challenge and a good response.
So are you working on anything right now?
I'm getting ready to go to the in New York at the end of the month and give a few talks there. And we're continuing to organize with One Struggle and trying to build an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist mass movement in different places and in different ways. I think the one thing that I'd really like to focus on in the coming period is the fact that they're planning to do fracking in Florida, which I think will be an incredible disaster.
Yeah.
And it will definitely pollute our water and poison all of us, and we really need to stop that from happening. So I think a focus on that for a while would be very important.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, I'm going to ask you to join me again sometime soon because I regularly get progressive activists and progressive journalists together to kind of talk about some of the topics that are current. And I'm going to be having you back again to join us with those because I think that another cartoonist on the mat would be a good idea.
Great, I would really love to, Rick.
Oh, listen, you know, you bring a wonderful spirit to this adventure. When we talk about economic troubles, do you think there's any chance at all that, you know, once again the Republicans just thwarted a rise in minimum wage? Anybody with an honest assessment of what's been going economically has to see that these economic policies that have crushed any chance of increasing wages, the massive exchange of funds from the 99% to the 1%, it's so obvious. Do you think there's any chance we can get our current Congress to recognize this?
No, I think they'll only raise the minimum wage if we fight for it. I think that's where the mass movement comes in, the need for a mass movement of working people to assert their rights and fight for them. And I think that's the only time that governments have ever made a concession to the needs of the people, which is when we have demanded it and fought for it. And that means through protests, through strikes, whatever it takes. And this is the fight that's going on globally. People are rising up in places like Haiti, Bangladesh, Cambodia for a rise in their minimum wage too, because the capitalists only want to give us the bare minimum, what they can get away with, even less than it takes for us to survive. And if we're going to force them to give us more and have a decent life, then we have to assert ourselves collectively as a powerful force that we are, because the people who work and make things are the people who run, who really make society function. And the factory owners and the capitalists and the people who are in control of these businesses are basically stealing what workers produce and living the high life off of the backs of the people, and that has to be turned around.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, and you'll be invited back real soon. Usually at least once a month I have a roundtable of progressive communicators and journalists, and I'll be calling you again real soon. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great, thanks. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay, you take care.
You too, bye.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, the next guest of our art show is a really wonderful saxophonist, musician extraordinaire, and I'd like to welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Randy Emmerich, saxophonist extraordinaire. Welcome, Randy. How are you?
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Pretty good, buddy. Pretty good. And yourself?
I'm doing just fine. I've been enjoying the show, and this is my first time ever doing this, so I'll take all the help I can get.
Okay, no problem, no problem. We try to make this absolutely painless and maybe even a little bit of fun. Let me start off with a couple tough questions.
Okay.
You're a saxophonist. You've been a saxophonist for quite some time. When did you first pick up the saxophone, sir?
My dad was a saxophone player, and he found out that starting on the saxophone and trying to make it a living of it was harder than starting out on clarinet and then picking up the saxophone later. So I actually started on clarinet. I don't think my dad forced me to do it. I think he might have surreptitiously encouraged me to do that. But the first instrument I picked up was clarinet, and I just studied it. Oh, the same as a classical clarinet player would study clarinet.
Sure.
And later on, I decided my dad was absolutely right, because switching to saxophone was easier than being a saxophone player and switching to clarinet. The clarinet has a few more notes to learn and a few problems like open holes. And so when it came to switch to saxophone, I'm not saying it's an easier instrument. I'm just saying that the transition is a little easier. So I actually picked up the saxophone about the time I entered high school, which is about 1961. And I just did it, well, probably because I admired my dad. And there was a chance to play in the high school stage band, and I wanted to do that too.
Well, let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I
had the advantage of having all these instruments laying around the house too, so I didn't even have to buy anything.
Well, that does make it nice. Did your dad play part-time professionally?
He was
a
full-time musician in the swing era.
And, oh, my goodness.
He played in what they used to call territory bands in the Midwest. They didn't play all over the country. They would play certain sections of the country. And there was a lot of live music then, and people could make a living doing that. They would do occasional broadcasts out of Cincinnati and Dayton. And then the rest of the time they were just traveling from one old ballroom to another.
So you got a chance to hear a lot of live music when you were young as well, huh?
Yes, I did. I got lucky that way. I think the Midwest is a little bit behind. What was going on in New York and L.A. hadn't really reached Ohio, and at least not the same extent. And so people were listening to a little bit older music. They were still listening to swing bands and big bands, and I got a chance to do that before it completely died out. And,
well, I'd
so
say halfway between Kansas City and New York, huh?
Yeah. So being behind the times was actually an advantage to me.
Well, those eras were such great eras for Reedman. My goodness, that wonderful rich sax section, that's some great music back then.
Yeah, I got a big kick out of it. That was my first inspiration. And the first professional jobs I did were either playing Dixieland clarinet or playing saxophone in a big band. I think my first job was my own high school prom.
No kidding. No kidding. That's great. Let me ask you this. When, with your father being a bit of an inspiration for you, did you know at a young age you wanted to make a profession out of music?
No, I actually didn't want to make a profession out of it. When I was younger, it was pretty easy to see that it was getting more and more difficult to make a living playing music. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I didn't plan on being a musician. When I went to college, I was a psychology major, and I had thought about being an engineer. And so I didn't really intend to do this. I just found myself playing in all kinds of bands. And so before I decided to become a musician, I already was one. And people would say, well, you'll always be out of work if you were a musician, and I'd already been playing for years and never been out of work, and so I just kind of fell into it.
Excellent. Well, let me ask you this. When did you come south?
I went on the road. I was working. Well, here's the next part. Rather than being a big band musician, I was playing in Dayton, Ohio, in nightclubs with a rhythm and blues band, and there was a lot of work at the time. Dayton was a factory town, and things were going strong for the economy, and there were lots of clubs in town that had bands big enough to have a horn section. So I started working with a rhythm and blues band, and I was in the house band at a local nightclub when Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders came through town. And they needed a saxophone player. I auditioned for the job, and I ended up going on the road with them. So the guys in Wayne Cochran's CC Riders, about half the band was from New Orleans, and most of the other guys were from Miami. So I met a lot of connections in Miami and New Orleans. And actually, when I left Wayne, I went to New Orleans first for almost a year, and then finally came to Miami just because there was a steady job here.
Let me ask you this. Wayne Cochran, for those of us who knew his work, was a real performer, a full tilt boogie, scream and shouter kind of guy. What was your impression of him as a person, as a band leader?
Wayne has a very, very good, he has a lot of common sense. Let's put it that way. He's not extremely educated, but he's a very smart guy, and he knows what works and doesn't work, and he is a natural entertainer. He's very extroverted, and he's got a lot of talent. Plays a little guitar and he sings, and it's the place to see Wayne is live. You almost have to see him live just because of the bizarre spectacle that he used to put on. And the band was kind of a separate entity, and the band kind of ran itself, although I got to give Wayne credit for coming up with a lot of the ideas for how to present the band. And so his commercial horse sense was very valuable to the band. And at the time, when there were almost no big bands anywhere, the band I joined had 11 horns.
That's
a big band by anybody's estimation.
Plus a good-sized rhythm section, I imagine, right?
No, small rhythm section. We only had guitar, bass, and drums. We never had a keyboard player.
No kidding.
We did have a keyboard player for a short time, but usually not. The horn section was kind of the keyboard, and the arranger was a guitar player, and he was a very good rhythm guitar player. And we would always get the bass player and drummer that had the best feel. Hopefully they could read music, but if they didn't read very well, the guitar player could show them what needed to be shown without having them read the charts. And everybody read a little bit, but we weren't known for our ability to read. We were mostly known for having a good feel and being a tight band.
Well, I think it's probably time to play a little Mr. Cochran. How about Do You Like? I guess...
What do you got?
I got Do You Like and I got We Make It.
Do You Like the Sound of the Music is...
Yep.
More of a typical Wayne Cochran thing. It's up tempo, and play that one first because that's pretty typical of what he was doing when I was in the band.
Okay, here we go. Well, that is certainly a high-energy performance band, huh?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And Wayne was always putting on a gigantic show. And the band was choreographed also on that particular tune. We didn't
do
any steps or anything until the middle of the tune when he said, you got to get that groove. Then the choreography started, at least when we were doing it in Las Vegas. And so sometimes they would start out the evening with just the rhythm section on stage, and then they would bring the horns up as part of the presentation of the band. And we would do a couple of band tunes before Wayne even came out. When I first joined the band, we had two female singers. So it would start out with just the rhythm section, then they'd bring up the horns, then they'd bring the two girls out, than we do. It would gradually build and build and build. By the time Wayne hit the stage, things were cooking pretty good already, and Wayne just lifted it a little higher. The usual formula for the band was for the rhythm section to play, the horns would come in, Wayne would sing with the horns, and then on the way out, we'd go into a vamp, and the horns would play, and then the trumpets would take it up, and then finally the lead guitar player would just dump all the volume controls and blow over the top of the trumpets. By the time it was all said and done, it was pretty exciting.
I guess. Now, you guys traveled in a bus, I guess?
Yep, a 42-passenger bus. And
wow.
That's really the best way to travel because it takes you, you know, door to door. We did all our own loading and unloading and setting up and everything like that. We didn't have any roadies, but at least we didn't have to carry stuff around an airport. And all we had to do was get on the bus after we loaded everything up and fall asleep. Sometimes we'd get to a hotel and stay, and sometimes we'd have to drive all night. So we usually did one-nighters. Sometimes we'd travel as much as 600 miles between two shows.
Wow.
It was actually illegal for bus drivers to drive straight through that way. Sometimes we'd have to stop at an airport where they would fly in another bus driver to take us on the second half of the hop.
Really?
But there were a lot of times when we did several hundred miles and play shows on adjacent nights. And you really didn't mind it because if you slept on the bus, you didn't have to pay for a hotel room.
Right. Now, this is what the archetypal phrase show band was all about, right? So you said in addition to choreography, you guys, I'm sure, all had costumes?
Yeah, we sure did. The first costume I got with Wayne was a jumpsuit that was, it was a one-piece pants that had suspenders. It was cut like a pair of bib overalls, except they were skin tight, and they were double-stitched like jeans, except that the denim that they were made out of was black and the double stitching was in red. And then there was a coat that went over that, and then over the coat we had a cape that was lined in red satin.
Oh, my goodness.
So we come out, and after we did a couple of tunes, we'd rip off the capes and throw them away and do the rest of the show just in the tuxes. Wayne had that outfit was made by Nudie's Rodeo Tailors out in L.A. He's the guy that did all the wild outfits for all of the country and western acts like Porter Wagoner. And Wayne's outfit was every bit as wild as anything Porter Wagoner ever wore. He would have roses. He'd have a floor-length cape with a rose on the back of it about 3 feet in diameter, and the edges of the rose would be all done up in rhinestones. They were actually beautiful suits. And some of the other outfits were a little less elegant, but they were, we went to a guy in Tampa. There was a place in Tampa called Michael and Tony's Tailors. And they did outfits for rock and roll people. They did a lot of stuff for Jimi Hendrix. And so we had ourselves custom measured, and they made us uniforms with stars all over them and buttons up the side of the pants. And they were pretty wild-looking outfits. And they looked great on stage. They were very effective.
Imagine they wore pretty good, too.
Yeah, and they smelled pretty good after about 3 or 4 days before we hit the place that had dry cleaners.
Oh, my goodness.
So, because you would finish the show just drenched in sweat.
Soaked, sure.
It would be impossible to get them clean for a few days if you're doing one-nighters.
So how long were you on the road with Cochran?
Almost 5 years.
Wow.
I always wanted to go on the road, but I thought, you know, I'd like to do it for a year or so just to see what it was like. And Wingspan was a lot of fun because everybody got along really well, and everyone tried to help everyone else out musically. So if somebody joined the band and was maybe not up to snuff in one aspect of his playing or something like that, the rest of the band would sit him down, and rather than give him a hard time, they'd do everything they could to help him out. And when you find yourself in an environment like that, you'll learn a lot, you'll get better, and it's a very pleasant situation, and you can just watch yourself grow day to day. It's a wonderful way to learn music.
So let's play another Mr. Cochran's tune. So, do you like the music? Let's give this one a try.
Okay.
We make it.
Yeah, we will.
what I remember of that that band was the high energy stuff, and I was going to ask you, did he do some ballads? Clearly, he did some blues.
Yeah, we would always do at least one ballad every show, and that tune there, a lot of people would comment, "Oh, that's interesting how you did that song in three different tempos." And the drummer, Alan Robinson, would always say, "Nah, man, it's all the same tempo. It starts out as a ballad, and then he breaks up the time differently in the middle, and at the end he breaks up the time in a totally different way." It was wonderful having Alan as a drummer, because the tempo, no matter what happened, the tempo never moved. No matter how exciting it got, it never rushed. And you could play the slowest tempo imaginable, and it would never just go down the tubes, because he would hold it there forever. And the guitar player who was the arranger of that and co-writer of that tune was Charles Brent, and he was a genius at writing arrangements like that. That particular song is interesting because the introduction, the slow instrumental introduction on that, is what inspired Jaco Pastorius to write the introduction for The Chicken that's on one of his records. And The Chicken's one of Jaco's most popular tunes. And right before The Chicken starts, he has a thing called Soul Intro. And if
right.
you listen to the introduction to We're Gonna Make It, and if you listen to the introduction to the Soul Intro for The Chicken, you'll see where Jaco got the idea. It's there's nothing stolen, but it's the same kind of an idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you another question. You know, I could see where being on the road with a band like this, you can really get plugged into some lively music. It might not be technically, you know, at the highest level, but that's not what this kind of music is. This, you know, rock and soul is about feel. And were you keeping up your rehearsing? Were you practicing, should we say, a more in another vein, or were you basically just working on the rock stuff during that period?
We didn't rehearse very much. What we would do would be we would rehearse enough to know how the song would be put together. And then we would have to memorize everything, which we got to the point where you could do that pretty quickly. Some of Charlie's arrangements actually were very complex. They were they actually rehearsed a little, needed a little bit of woodshedding to get them together technically. But what kept everybody in shape was Wayne's show involved Wayne going out in the audience and tearing the club apart. And it's hard to give anybody a true impression of what that was, but at some point in the show, he would go out in the audience and go behind the bar and grab six or eight bottles of booze, and then he'd walk on all the tables and pour booze into everybody's glass and destroy the drink that they had, so they had to order another one. And then he would throw the bottles through the ceiling of the club. They'd usually get hung up in the acoustical tile, and alcohol would be dripping out of the ceiling. And then he'd throw the swizzle sticks and cocktail napkins all over the place. And while that was going on, the band, the rhythm section stayed on stage, and the horn section went out into the audience, and we did our own version of what they used to call walking the bar. Usually you would just get up on the tables and just make up riffs, and it went on for a long time. That was usually, you know, 15 minutes or so, and every night we would make up a completely different musical background to Wayne's Destruction Derby. And so our rehearsals were the shows themselves.
Playing every night, you probably didn't, you know, I mean, that the show was, the rehearsal was the show.
Yeah, no two shows were the same. And the next night we would make up totally different parts. And some of those parts kind of lived on. There were things, we would steal things from other bands and put them together in different ways, or just make up things on our own.
Now, this is early to mid-60s, or is this going into the late 60s?
This would have been 71 through 75. But
okay,
Wayne was doing that. Wayne was doing that in 1965.
Yeah.
And it continued into the, you know, early 70s, maybe mid-70s.
And you were on the road in the early mid-70s?
I was on the road from like 71 to 75. And so that particular concept of the show went on almost the entire time. And a lot of, that's what a lot of people came to see. We would play clubs where the destruction from the show would be left unrepaired to cause people to talk about what had happened. And then when we came back the next time, there'd be twice as many people there, just, you know, because the ceiling was still ripped out and I don't know. So there were very few club owners that were disappointed when the club got destroyed. It usually paid off in better business.
Well, that's good. So at what point did you decide, did the band leave the road, or did you decide that you had a better option? How did you
I was always worried about would I be able to find a steady job that would, you know, actually let me make a living. I finally got an offer from some guys in New Orleans, most of whom, or some of whom, had been in Wayne's band before, that had a steady job in a nightclub there. And at the time, New Orleans was just wide open. Not so much in the French Quarter. There was plenty going on in the French Quarter, but they had a nightclub section called Fat City, and they had probably a dozen nightclubs that featured live music, and a lot of those clubs had two bands. One would play from 7 to 11. The other band would play from 11 o'clock until the wee hours of the morning. And so we worked a couple of different clubs in the area with a band called the Jackson Brewing Company that was named after the brewing company that made Jack's beer, which is a New Orleans beer. And we just did, it was a wonderful band, and we just did a lot of the same kind of things that Wayne did. And when work got a little slow with that band, I just got a call from a friend of mine, Jeff Foreman, who had been playing here in Miami for decades, always had a band going, and he offered me a job here, and that's when I finally came to Miami.
Now, the beach was quite a scene in those days, right?
Yeah, it was. We played the Newport Hotel, and There were a lot of clubs. I can't even think of all of them, but there were probably dozens of clubs that had a band. And
Castaways is another one I remember.
Right. Let me think. Yeah, I worked at Castaways, not with the first band that I played with in Miami, but we did that, and we went around to a lot of different clubs. There was the Big Daddy's chain of clubs. There was the Marco Polo had bands. I can't even think of them all. There were so many. And we were never out of work. As soon as we would finish at one club, we would move to another club.
Backing a lot of front acts at this point? Or was
no,
the house band
it was a self-contained band. It was the disco era, but we weren't. The bands I worked with were doing top 40, and top 40 at the time usually involved a lot of disco. But we had we were able to cover a lot of different styles, and what people wanted was music that they were familiar with, so we would cover whatever was happening on the radio at the time. I finally decided to get out of doing that when I got a chance to work on a ship job. I always wanted to be able to, for one thing, play baritone saxophone a lot. I always admired the baritone saxophone player in Wayne's band. His name is Bob Gable, and he's a legendary rock and roll baritone player. But I like the instrument after hearing him play it. And then I got an offer to work a ship job where I would play baritone sax all the time and double on clarinet. And so I did that for about a year and a half. And while I was doing that, I was studying flute with a legit flute teacher in Miami and just trying to get my doubles together the best I could. Mm-hmm. So when I came out of that job, I was a better baritone player and a better flute player, and I kind of got my clarinet chops back because I'd been ignoring them for 4 or 5 years. And at that point, I got a chance to work with, it was another top 40 band, much like the one that I was doing before I went on the ship. And I did that for a year, year and a half, and then started with the Impact of Brass, which was an instrumental show band. And we were doing, here again, all kinds of music. It was some rock and roll, some R&B. The Impact had been a world tour, and so we would reprise some of the music that that they did then. And
well, listen,
it was another
I've got
chance.
A cut.
Yeah.
I've got a cut of you, I think, featured on some Barry with that soul intro of Jocko's. This is from Japan?
Yeah.
Okay, let me play this, and you can talk about the band and the set, okay?
Okay, sure. Stick it on. We'll be right back.
Oh, that was tearing it up.
Yeah, that was probably the highlight of my career, is the Japanese tour with Jaco. That was Randy Brecker on electric trumpet. My wife Michelle calls him the electric elephant on that instrument because he sounds so wild. And there was Bobby Minter was the tenor soloist, and Othello Molyneux was the steel pan soloist. And the band was a real all-star band. It was really fantastic. We went around all over Japan playing that. And it was just a wonderful experience. I got to thank Jaco for taking me over there.
So you had some you began to broaden your experience, I guess, from the show bands and the top 40 stuff to broaden into jazz. I know you also play classical as well.
I worked with the Palm Beach Pops, and before that the what they called the Florida Symphonic Pops at Boca Raton, or the Boca Pops. And we didn't do a lot of heavy orchestral music, but we would do a little bit of classical music, and we would do some light classics and pop influence stuff. And usually on the second half of the concert, we would back up some sort of an act that used a large string section to present themselves. So it was a chance to work with some more stars, and it was a chance to work with some of the classical players here in South Florida, which is something that's really great for me. Those guys can play anything. You just put any kind of music in front of them and they nail it the first time, and I've always admired them for doing that.
So you work with quite a few people on the local jazz scene. Why don't you talk a bit about the local jazz scene?
Local jazz scene is going pretty well down here. I kind of think that Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach is almost like New York back in the 60s, because we actually have several nightclubs where you can hear live jazz and not spend a whole lot of money. And you can almost go out and hear live jazz any night of the week. Blue Jean Blues is one venue where I've played a little bit. If you look at any of the New Times or any of the magazines that tell you what's going on in town, there's usually a whole column of jazz clubs. Up in Palm Beach County, there's the Arts Garage and all kinds of places. It's nice to see that happen. I don't think anybody's making a whole lot of money, but I think that they're able to keep playing and keep live jazz alive, and that's something that's not going on very often anywhere nowadays. So I know several of the better jazz players here in town. They're working every night, and they're doing real well, and that's not something that you could say about anywhere in the country for a long time. So we're really lucky in South Florida to have that kind of an opportunity to go hear live jazz. I just hope people will actually do it. There's nothing quite like actually sitting 5-10 feet away from the artist that you want to hear and hearing it live. It's nice to hear it in an intimate, you know, fireside situation at home on a record, but you can go to a nightclub in Florida and sit within spitting distance of the artist you want to hear and hear him live. And that's a wonderful situation. It's something that really impressed me when I was a kid, and the opportunity still exists here in Florida.
Well, you're a saxophonist with a whole wide range of styles, and you've worked in a variety of arenas. And I found a recording online of you playing something called the Littlest Saxophone Quartet. Let me play this and you can tell us about it.
Okay.
¶¶
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I see you were joined by a very talented saxophonist yourself.
Yeah, that was that's an arrangement.
Hello? Hello? Well, it looks like we got cut off. And the final few seconds of the show, I want to mention, don't forget to tune in to our other special progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart, her show Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Baguil, and Sita Media, Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People. I'm your host, Rick Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Talk to you next week. Thanks very much. I thank my special guest, Randy Emmerich, my other guest, Stephanie McMillan. Thanks so much. I'm so glad you could join us tonight. Bye-bye.
Good night.